российские хакеры используют крайне
взлом были серверы ЦРУ.
Россия – виртуальное мафиозное государство.
Организованная преступность сменилась.
В России сложно отличить правительство от мафии.
Основной канал поставок незаконного
оружия. Меряются эксклюзивными дворцами, мега-яхтами, швейцарскими часами.
From cyberattacks to arms trafficking, crime in Russia isn't always just crime. Sometimes it's a tool of statecraft. The security services have effectively tamed and co-opted the fabled Russian mafia, a web of criminal networks with global reach, and turned it into a lethal weapon in Moscow's showdown with the West. So how is the Kremlin deploying the gangster weapon, and how effective is it? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian organized crime, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there.
And also joining us via Skype from Oxford, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Habiger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at Miami University in Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Welcome back, Karen.
Thanks a lot.
Well, Spanish prosecutor Jose Grinda, who prosecuted a major case against the Tambovska Grupovka in Spain, has noted that the activities of Russia's criminal networks are virtually indistinguishable from those of the government. Russia, Grinda added, has become a, quote, virtual mafia state. Mark, I know you don't like that formulation, so I'll cite you to you. Mark, in a lecture at the Hudson Institute last week, you noted that Russia isn't so much a mafia state as a state with a nationalized mafia. Speaking in terms of foreign policy here, and I want to keep it to that mostly today, and leaving aside whether Russia is a mafia state or not, or whether we like that or not, how is Russia using this nationalized asset? If you're saying Russia has a nationalized mafia, how is it using that asset now?
Well, obviously, it's important to start just by noting that not every organized crime grouping is controlled by the state, and there is still proper policing going on. It's a process that is more about collusion and sometimes co-optation. And what we see, I think, internationally is, first of all, that from time to time, organized crime can be used as muscle, real muscle. We saw that most obviously in Crimea. We've seen it in the Donbass, and we can expect to see it elsewhere, that where they need warm bodies on the ground who can actually sort of project Russian power, this is in some ways an extension of the mercenary principle. So that's way number one. Second, and I think perhaps most important, is use of organized crime as an intelligence asset, which is worth noting need not actually be Russian or Eurasian organized crime. Anyone who's willing to be hired becomes potential. And we can point to several examples. Most recently, there was the case of the Estonian security officer, Eston Kõrva, who was kidnapped across the border when he was investigating a cigarette smuggling ring, which may well have had Federal Security Service, FSB, involvement. Now, that could simply have been just some local FSB person who was involved in a corrupt activity, but that doesn't quite explain the massive operation that was deployed. So instead, I think it's much more likely that this is a classic case in which the FSB and other intelligence operatives within Russia use organized crime as a way of generating funds and also then moving those funds to where they can then spend them. So these are operational funds that are not having to come out of the Kremlin's budget and not having to be smuggled across the border, but are actually can be generated by criminal activity abroad. So that's one example of intelligence activity. And I give a second one. Victor Boot, who's currently languishing in prison in the United States, the notorious arms dealer, merchant of death, and so forth, he seemed to have had a fascinating career that straddles being an arms dealer, being an illegal arms dealer, which is after all different, and also probably being a GRU officer, an officer of military intelligence. And the point is, he was not 100% any of those things. He did arms deals, both legal and illegal, but from time to time it looks as if the Russian state would lean in and say, essentially, as the price for your continuing to enrich yourself, we have something that we need done. And that's how it's done. And I think that is actually often the model. It's not that, as it were, these are full-time intelligence operatives or whatever. It's just that they are there to be used when need be. And the final element, I think, for the internationalization of Russian organized crime as a tool is, of course, just simply more broadly the movement of money. The movement of money, and it's very hard to distinguish between these different tracks, but for the purpose of supporting convenient political movements at arm's length, for the purpose of just allowing the laundering and moving of corrupt officials' funds, and also to essentially create channels for influence. The more people become dependent upon Russian money of dubious origin, the more they get used to the idea that in some ways or another they are being suborned by the Russian state.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with that. I think that what we have in Russia is a state that is selectively, very selectively, controlling mafia activities. They clearly work to structure the market to favor some activities and some people and suppress other activities. Their choice of who they favor. And we're looking at foreign policy here, is based on who can provide the best sharing of profits to individuals within state structures, who is willing to take orders from state structures, who provides the most opaque black operations services. Who is helping in breaking sanctions? I mean, mafias all over the world, they cross borders. They help money flow and they break sanctions. And I mean, I think this is a huge aspect of what we have always seen in Russia, but now it's increased because of the imposition of sanctions. Mm-hmm. Not only Western sanctions, but Russian self-sanctions in terms of food. Who is delivering the Parmesan? So, the sanctions regime, but the dual sets of sanctions regimes, the Russian and the Western, provide opportunities for mafia to cross borders and become even more useful to state services.
Now, Karen, you raised the issue of who's willing to share profits, and I think that actually gets to an important thing here, is whether we look at Russia as a mafia state or a state with a nationalized mafia. Is it just profits, or are there goals of state that are independent of profits for people who occupy high positions in the state, if you see this?
Well, if we were to take, for example, Russian-Syrian relations as an example, Syria has been under sanctions longer than Russia has been under Western sanctions. So, they are otherwise very similar regimes. So there are people in both countries now who are under Western sanctions who need to operate internationally in the sense of they want their money to flow. They want to secure their money. They want to maximize their money. And they have individual objectives. Of course, survivability is also important in the case of the Syrian regime. But if we're just talking about the criminal aspect of it, when you have sanctions, you have the growth of people in the state sector who before could go down to their local Deutsche Bank branch and do a mirror trade with Germany, right? That's now, as we know, right, become a little bit more difficult. So the imposition of sanctions, whether they're in Syria or in Russia, drive these sanctioned regimes together and increase the use of state structures that can operate in the underground. Mm-hmm. So clean structures find it more difficult to operate in a sanctioned environment. And we saw that, for example, in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So the UN Oil for Food program led to the emergence of the UN Bakshish for right. fuel program. It was, it was a huge boon to the growth of the underground economy in Iraq.
Mark, your thoughts on this? Are there reasons of state, or just profits involved here?
No, I definitely think there's reasons of state. I mean, I think I'm not entirely sure if I'd agree, or at least if I've seen evidence of sanctions driving, for example, Syria and Russia any closer together in underworld or upper world terms than they were before. I think the thing is that we have to realize that in Russia, organized crime is weaker than the state. It is powerful. It is extensive, but the state is much more powerful. I mean, if we want to conceptualize it in those terms, the biggest gang in town is run from the Kremlin rather than anywhere else. And I think there's three levels to think of when we look at Russia. There is a rational working state. Much of the time, things are run the way they ought to be, pretty much, you know, within the levels of petty corruption and inefficiencies that are not exactly unique to Russia. However, overlaying that, there is also a kind of a kleptocratic elite. The high-level corruption and embezzlement that we know all the time is deforming and distorting the activities of that rational state. In a way, it is dominant over that. But then I would say that dominant over that, and this is what means that sort of Russia is something that is quite distinctive, is a group of people who have clearly a certain state project in mind and who are not, in my opinion, motivated primarily by the quest for money. They have a bigger picture of, you know, a powerful Russia, a proud Russia, a sovereign Russia, yada, yada, yada. And I think that actually sort of tends to trump even the kleptocracy. So in that sense, I mean, yes, of course, we have a lot of cases of organized crime working in cahoots with corrupt officials, making money, moving money, giving money in return for impunity and everything else, more often domestically than internationally, I would say. But when we look internationally, I think it is clear that in a way the state reaches in, and whenever it finds some aspect in which organized criminal activities can be convenient to it, it reaches in and is able to basically say, look, you know that we can find you and we can deal with you. The price for us not unleashing the full barrage of weapons at our disposal is that you do this favor, this carry out this attack, do whatever. And often it's incredibly opportunistic. I mean, again, let me give one definite example from Syria. There's an increase in the use and flow of methamphetamines in, through, out of, and around Syria. And that's because both government forces and rebels use methamphetamines, if nothing else, just to keep alert. You know, it's a classic depressing aspect of war. So there's a lot of production going on. And what the interesting thing is we see is not just that there's use, but there's actually a lot of trafficking of methamphetamines across the front line between government and rebel areas and government and rebel forces. Now, given that Russian organized crime is quite heavily involved, not just in the supply of methamphetamines, but also in the necessary chemicals and expertise to produce methamphetamines, I would be surprised if, given the connection between Russians and Syrians, that's not already a sort of a factor. And in that case, I'd be very surprised, and certainly the Russians would be missing a trick. So, you know, if the SVR is listening, here's a hint. They could be using that trade and the people who are involved in that trade precisely as intelligence resources, because precisely they operate and have contacts across the front lines. So, I mean, I think this is it. It's actually individual situations arise, and that's when the state machine clicks in and says, right, we're going to use these people for this purpose.
Well, I would expand that. I might just add, Mark, in terms of evidence, let me just talk for a minute about evidence of Russian-Syrian cooperation in this regard. Look, the Russians have had a guarantor role in Syria since 1956. They've had a treaty of friendship since 1956. The Assad regime, when it came to power, within a year, gave Russia basing rights in Tartus. They have had an air base near Palmyra, which we know is now in ISIS hands. They had a signals base called Center C near the Golan Heights that they operated jointly with the Syrians. There isn't a Syrian intelligence officer in the Mukhabarat who has not been trained in Russia, not a single one. Military intelligence also entirely trained in Russia. Air Force entirely trained in Russia. So upper officer corps, entirely trained in Russia. And if you're flying Russian weapons, you have Russian advisors there. So this is a very significant, long-standing and serious connection. In addition to that, on the money front, when sanctions went into effect, how are the Syrians going to move money? So they have in Damascus, they have branches of Russian banks. Gazprom Bank operates in Syria. VTB operates in Syria. Vnesh Ekonom Bank operates in Syria. Of course, it's an economy that's not producing much and is needing money, not moving money, although the Assad regime itself requires a lot of money along the lines of the kleptocratic regime in Russia to maintain loyalty of its people. So how does it do that? It got a $1 billion credit line from Iran that was announced in January 2013, and it's using it mainly to get weapons from Russia. In addition to that, one of the most interesting economic relationships is who is pumping Syrian oil and gas? The Russians are, and not only the Russians, but very specific Russians. So Storitransgaz, owned by Timchenko, is present in Syria. And craziest of all, Itera. Now, Itera is a oil extraction company, which you may or may not remember, that is headquartered in Jacksonville, Florida. It operates on the same basis as Rosuker Energo. In other words, it buys from Russian state companies and sells at a different price, and nobody knows where the middle part goes. And Itera, therefore, I would imagine, is sharing money both with the Russians and with the Syrian regime. Itera was brought partially under the control of Rosneft. Tatneft is also there. So there is a very significant, I would say, Russian kleptocratic structure that is operating to undergird the Syrian regime itself. And I think we really do need to consider it. And just to add the methamphetamine to deepen the drug story, look, there are two huge heroin trafficking routes out of Afghanistan. One goes north to Russia directly and then into Europe. And of course, a lot of the heroin staying in Russia. And the other goes west into Iran, from Iran to Syria, from Syria to Hezbollah, into the Bekaa Valley, and then out to Europe through Lebanon. And there's a Russian trail in that as well. There's just no way it could move in those directions without a Russian trail.
Mark, I see you writing.
Well, I mean, I think no one is questioning that there's a long-term relationship between Syria and first the Soviet Union and then Russia. That's always the case. I think it's this specific point that sanctions necessarily draw regimes together. I mean, after all, if you think of the Russian oil link, I mean, Storitransgaz's connection with Syria was in 2010. So it necessarily predates that. I think, look, I mean, obviously, on one level, we don't know. The real kind of questionable activities are ones that it's very hard to sort of dig through. Certainly some of the money that the Syrians are getting and moving is actually going through Lebanon. And according to some suggestions, ironically, probably through Israel, which again is quite a nexus in the global dirty money hub, which Russians, amongst many others, are engaging. But again, I mean, I think there's two separate issues I think I want to sort of pull apart, and this is not necessarily in disagreement with you, but I think it's important to identify them. On the one hand, we have, shall we say, state-to-state relationships, which often actually involve a whole variety of covert as well as overt or arms-length activities. The other question is, as it were, how far specifically organized crime becomes involved. And the trouble is, you see, Syria at the moment is in many ways not a very engaging target for transnational organized crime. If you're going to smuggle things, you want to smuggle them through areas where actually they're not going to be raided or bombed or whatever, which is why most of the southern heroin actually goes Iran-Turkey rather than through Syria, because, well, it's a war zone. And I think from the Russians' point of view, I think two things really obtain. One is, obviously, where do Russian organized crime groupings extend their contacts and such like? Because after all, the Russians are, you know, as you yourself have said, you know, they're tremendously entrepreneurial. And secondly, it's where can they actually provide something specifically that the Russian state and the Russian intelligence community really need? In Syria, for example, absolutely, because of these connections, the Russians also have a deep, deep other bench of assets to which they can turn. In some ways, what always worries me more is the capacity that organized crime gives the Russians to operate in areas where they don't have lots of other resources in place. Places like North America, places like Western Europe, places like Japan. I mean, it's interesting that there's some suggestions, for example, that Russian gangs that are cooperating with Korean gangs in Japan, since the Korean gangs are the outsiders compared with the ethnically Japanese Yakuza, they're a bit more desperate, a little bit more willing to make deals. And if there's an intelligence dimension there, again, it gives the Russians access into places that they wouldn't necessarily otherwise have. For me, that is one of the particularly worrying issues.
What do you see going on there? Because that's actually quite interesting. We've seen a lot of reports lately about the uptick in cybercrime, for example, and the uptick in hacking. In the last couple of years, we've had everything from the White House to the State Department to the House of Representatives to the New York Times to Polish stock markets to German steelmakers to French television stations hacked. And it's the opinion of at least the Western intelligence officials that have been cited in the reports that I've read, saying that these are not freelancers. They're working explicitly for the Kremlin. The way this has been done has been explained, that the FSB has been very good at identifying particularly talented hackers in the underworld and then co-opting them. Starting a criminal case with them and then making that criminal case disappear if they would do something for the state. If you could speak a little to the cybercrime and other areas where we're seeing the kind of the gangster weapon, if you will, being used in places like North America, Western Europe, and Japan.
You know, well, sorry, Karen, do go on.
Well, I was just going to make one point, and then, you know, Mark, take it up, that we have a situation in Russia where Skolkova is not going to be a center for true entrepreneurship anytime soon. So we have brilliant computer scientists, multinational computer scientists, working for their own profit and for entrepreneurial objectives in Silicon Valley. In the absence of that in Russia, what do those people do? Of course, they could emigrate to Silicon Valley, but if they don't want to emigrate or they're interested in different kinds of profits, you know, they can be hired by the state. And I think it is a great tragedy for Russia from that point of view that Skolkova is not producing the kind of entrepreneurial opportunities that Silicon Valley, that were promised along the lines of Silicon Valley. And so people go into the underground. If they want to make money, they go into the underground as hackers, and they get bought up by the state. It's a feature of the lack of options for talented people in Russia.
Mark?
Yeah, I think there are quite a few options. I mean, one can even just simply look at Kaspersky Labs, one of the, you know, the world's biggest antivirus companies that's based in Russia. There's actually quite a bit of high-tech activity there. I mean, I think that maybe sort of the 90s, this was particularly a factor. Nowadays, I think it's more that there are lots of people who don't want to do that kind of thing and who hack for fun and profit, but not necessarily simply because they can't get a job as a regular sort of computer programmer. But absolutely, there's a lot of really smart people. And the relationship seems to be not so much that these people become kind of full-time employees of the FSB, though the FSB clearly is the lead cyber defense and offense agency within the Russian system ever since it swallowed most of FAPSI, the government telecommunications, sort of the NSA or GCHQ analog agency. It's more, again, it's this thing of there are hackers, and at some point they will come on the radar screen of the authorities, whether it's the FSB or whether it's the Interior Ministry's K Division. And in some cases, what happens is it just simply is the case that they're told, right, well, from time to time, we will tell you to do something. We may pay you, or we may just simply allow you not to go to prison.
Yeah.
And when that happens, then you have to respond. It may well be that days, weeks, months, I have no idea, will go by in which they're just simply able to do their own thing. But sometimes along comes. And I'm almost tempted, I sort of feel we're beginning to wander into sort of the Godfather territory and that sense of, I will do you a favor, but, right. but someday I will come back. Well, I think the FSB, though, it's some days mm-hmm. we will come back. And whether, I mean, even if one looks at the cyber campaigns that were launched against Georgia and Estonia, clearly facilitated, whipped up, and in some cases with sort of scripts being provided. But the actual foot soldiers were either quote-unquote patriotic hackers who were just genuinely thinking, hey, this is cool, let's join in the attack for the sake of the motherland. Or in other cases, clearly, shall we say, professional hackers who were just simply told, you're now part of this for as long as this attack continues. So again, I mean, I think one of the problems we have in conceptualizing, but also in fighting this issue, is precisely that it is not a nice, straightforward, binary thing. Are you a gangster or are you a spook? It's actually gangsters can, when the spooks require it, be co-opted for as long as the spooks require it, because otherwise bad things will happen to them. So, I mean, absolutely, with cybercrime, although clearly it's a global, it's not just a Russian thing. The majority of hacks are still associated with Chinese and East Asians. But the difference is that whereas a lot of the Chinese attacks are much, much more likely to be for economic purposes, Russian ones are more disproportionately likely to be for political / making it sound rather twee, mischief-making purposes. And that is something that we've seen for some time. And it's not only that it's not showing any signs of abating, but actually, if anything, it's becoming more sharply visible. And I think we're beginning to see a bit of discussion within the Russian kind of professional military strategic press, much more about the whole sort of how you integrate information war into other forms of non-kinetic warfare. So in other words, they're really putting some serious thought into this whole question of not just, isn't it fun to mess with people at strategic moments, but how could you really, if you really wanted to, sort of whether it's deploying your little green men or using some other more serious challenge, how do you make sure that you get most bang for buck through your hacking?
How much are the traditional Russian organized crime groups or Eurasian organized crime groups? I mean, things like Solntsevo. How much are they into cybercrime? Do they have their own hackers? When the FSB is kind of finding these talented hackers that they want to co-opt for whatever cause they want, where are they looking? Are they looking into the traditional structures?
It's hard to tell. And I mean, I'd be interested to hear if Karen has insights on that. I don't get the sense that they do. I mean, I think anyway, we should note that a lot of these things like Solntsevo, they are networks rather than what you might think of as sort of old style, traditional hierarchical gangs where you're definitely, a member or a foot soldier or a captain or whatever. In some ways, they are networks of smaller groups that have more traditional sort of connections and structures. My sense is that the hackers still are essentially more semi-detached professionals rather than actually what we might think of as members of gangs. Obviously, Solntsevo and the others, they're involved in a lot of cyber crimes. But it's more, I think, that they buy in the expertise when they need it. And they're often involved then with the sort of, once the credit card details have been stolen, they may well have the little factoriette that then embeds it onto a blank card that then other people can go out and use. But the actual hack will probably take place, someone whom you just said, go and get me 100,000 credit card numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the way, in a perfect world, we could conceptualize this. The Chinese hacking, theoretically, we believe, is controlled by the state entirely. May or may not be, but we believe it to be. American hacking is by criminal organizations is completely attacked by the state. It may or may not be, but we believe it to be. The reason why we have so much trouble conceptualizing what's going on in Russia is that it lies in between. And it's the state's attitude toward it has also changed over time. So we have now a situation in which financial flow experts say half of the world's economy is in the black. All states should have an equal interest in making sure that they know what's happening in this zone. Mm. But it is clearly the case that that's not happening. And while America might, or the Western states might theoretically be posited as those groups of states that are not wanting financial flows to go into the black zone, clearly it's the case that Russia and to some extent China are using the black zone. So the deep internet, who's controlling the deep internet? Where is it coming from? It's a very, could it be closed down if states wanted to close it down? It's clearly the case that there's penetration of the deep internet by all intelligence services. Some that are kleptocrats who are moving their own money, individuals within states who are moving their own money through the deep internet out and about. And it's also being penetrated by states who are trying to follow this money. So there's a huge game that's being played in the black economy. And when we see things happening that's why I think the Deutsche Bank story is so significant, that there are institutions in the West that don't want to lose their Russian clients, and they'll do what is necessary, including getting their money out through illegal means to maintain market share in banking circles. This is why people are quite worried about the subversion of Western, or the complicity of Western institutions in this fight against what's happening in Russia, because we see Western institutions themselves enabling the entry of state monies into the black economy. Mm. So in terms of mafia, the deep internet, part of the deep internet is Silk Road, right? Mm. So when you can go on and look at what's for sale in terms of drugs, arms, trafficking in women and all that, and the states are looking at this too, and some states are promoting it. So of course there's a huge, huge game being played in which the internet is part of it. You don't need to move drugs through the Italian consulate in the covered market in Aleppo anymore. You can just order this stuff on the internet.
Right.
So the geography of all of these things has significantly changed. But that doesn't mean that kleptocratic states, which have a geographic formation, aren't specifically involved.
Mm. Mark, anything to add to that?
I mean, I think obviously at the moment everyone is still trying to get their minds, let alone their hands, round, particularly the deep net. And the whole nature of it is that it's not something that is amenable to that. It's a little bit like the event horizon. You know, the closer you get, the more it continues and it expands before you. I mean, I think for me, though, the interesting thing is the more that organized crime groups and intelligence services, and of course the significant areas where the Venn diagram of those two sort of spheres intersects, try and sort of move into these essentially uncharted and uncontrollable realms, the more actually it makes it harder for us to really know what the hell is going on, in the sense of not just what are the criminals doing, but what are our own state apparatus is doing. It makes it harder for accountability in the West, let alone in the sort of more wild and woolly sort of parts of the world. And I think this is a particular sort of concern, and I think it's a particular concern for a couple of reasons. One is because obviously it affects our ability at sort of maintaining accountability of our own intelligence apparatuses. But much more so, it continues to blur the lines between a whole variety of shadowy actors. The fact that exactly on the net you can be anyone. Now, we've known that in the sense of, I don't know, 40-year-olds pretending to be 14-year-old girls for the sake of all kinds of dubious activities. But the point is that also applies to the way that organizations can sometimes structure themselves. And it creates whole realms of deniability, whether it's the banker who wants to be able to operate financial structures which allow dirty money to come through his business, but provides him with the deniability that he then can't get caught for it, whether it's intelligence agencies that want to be able to hire hackers, and particularly it breaks down geographic boundaries. Mm-hmm. You know, once upon a time, on the whole, if spooks were going to talk to crooks, they would basically talk to their own. I mean, you know, there has been a variety of ways, for example, in which the American intelligence apparatus did make deals with the Cosa Nostra, whether it's in terms of handing over Sicily to the Allies in World War II, or whether it's in terms of trying to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Right.
Very, very specific instances, you know, because spooks, part of the job of a spook is to do things that the governments would like to have done, but in ways they don't want to know. But now I think it's increasingly the fact that we have this kind of globalized, organized crime world, which is especially facilitated by the internet, but it's not just about the internet. It's actually that now particularly ruthless spooks, particularly ruthless nations, and certainly Russia would count as one of those, are able to actually, as it were, shop in a global criminal market.
So it's not just about Eurasian gangs, as you said earlier. It's about the whole international community of organized crime.
Sure, and even if you look at the gangs, I mean, it's quite interesting. If one looks, for example, at Eurasian organized crime groups in the United States that have been rolled up, and sort of particularly with the RICO statute, which allows you to sort of basically take a whole group rather than just pick off individuals. It's fascinating because, you know, you will see Russians and Uzbeks and Armenians and Georgians, but then you will also see a variety of non-Eurasian Americans being part of it, and that's increasingly the trend.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing I'd add that to this is that while the international criminal networks are clearly multinational and are rolled up, when they're rolled up, we can see all kinds of odds and sods being arrested in the United States, there is a fundamental difference between the capability of these groups to operate in the United States and in Russia. If Russia wishes to engage in an information war with the United States, it doesn't need to give a wink-wink to criminal organizations. It sets up trolling factories. I mean, the state is doing a lot to enter the internet on the side of the opposite of truth and good government.
Right.
And this is a state action. That, I think, is really important. There has been, in the Russian space since Gorbachev opened the prisons, mafia operating. The difference is that now this mafia is operating at the behest of the state. It's not the same mafia as the 1990s. It's very different. And I do agree that we're not looking at Solntsev as a standard godfather structured with a single leader. Well, why is that? Because people who are made in Russia, and, you know, I bow down to Mark's expertise on this, you know, gave vows not to cooperate with the government. So what happens when the government takes over these structures? Different kinds of people emerge.
Mark, reference to the Vorf Zakonia there. I knew that was going to come up sooner or later. But,
Yeah, I mean, I think, let's be honest, though, this is part of the sort of the mythological past. I mean, the vows not to ever cooperate with the state, frankly, that was squeezed out during the so-called bitches wars, yeah, of the late 40s and 50s. You couldn't operate. And let's be honest, there was organized crime in the Soviet Union before Gorbachev. It just obviously was much less overt and much, much more operating essentially as the connective tissue between the black marketeers and corrupt party bosses. But the point is, you couldn't do that unless you were willing to in some ways cooperate with the state. And that's in some ways, I think, you know, again, going back to what's distinctive, and I definitely agree with Karen that we actually have the state itself is also operating, particularly in the information sphere. But I think one of the many, many pernicious legacies of the Soviet era is precisely not just that you actually have a thoroughly corrupt and self-interested elite, but also you have organized crime that has become completely accustomed to the idea that you have to operate with the indulgence of the state, whether that state means the local mayor or the state means the government in Moscow. But some way or another, you cannot operate as a maverick unless you really are a penny ante street corner gang.
Mm.
Unless you're Chechen.
Unless
you're... Well, even if you're Chechen, I mean, it's fascinating the extent to which During the Chechen Wars, they very, very clearly backed away from any sort of suggestion of supporting the rebels, because precisely Moscow made it clear that if they did, then never mind bothering with laws, there'll be people kicking down doors and people turning up dead by the roadside. Mm. I mean, I think, again, even the Chechens, for all their extraordinary formidable nature, realize that actually there are some boundaries and parameters, and the state gets to set them.
Before we move on to the second section, I want to get both of your thoughts on kind of taking everything we've discussed here and putting this in the context of this hybrid nonlinear warfare that Russia is waging with the West now in Ukraine and elsewhere. How does this weapon fit in? How and where is Russia using it most effectively? How does this fit into the whole mosaic that we've seen developing over the past couple of years? Mark?
Okay. I mean, it's very difficult to say, because if one says, where is it being used most effectively, the question becomes, well, where actually are the Russians most effective? And in some ways, I'm tempted to say that they are currently most effective inside the White House and inside Brussels. And that's really about politics. That's about their ability to basically seize the initiative, their capacity to basically play like a great power, and therefore, to an extent, be treated like a great power.
But there are building blocks to that on the ground.
There are building blocks to that. But in terms of, I mean, I think the fascinating thing is actually at the moment, we're much more, I think, in the realm of more old-fashioned geopolitics, you know, planes in Syria bombing things, than we were 6 months back. 6 months back, then, I think, actually, there was much more a case that one could see the use of I think, sort of, shall I say, criminality being effective in several areas. One is, yes, in terms of helping reduce the effect of sanctions, ranging from the cheese leggers on the Belarusian border to the rather more serious people who are involved in moving money in ways that is non-detectable or non-attributable by the authorities. Secondly, organized crime was helping as an intelligence asset. And I think it's clear that whether we're talking about the Baltic region or whether we're talking some more broadly, that it's a time of all hands on deck for the Russian intelligence community. It's more active now than it has ever been. I mean, this is the awful thing. Almost every time we talk about Russian intelligence these days, it's now at its greatest peak. Well, unfortunately, it continues to peak. And because there isn't so much more money available, they're looking more imaginatively mm-hmm. at the assets at their disposal.
So it's a source of income.
It's a source of income, but it's also a source of certain form. You know, if you want to get things and people across borders, if you just want to have someone who can pick up something and deliver it somewhere else, you know, all these kind of nuts and bolts activities, that's something that they definitely are able to do. So the second area is exactly the question of, giving a bonus to organized crime activities. And the third area, and it's hardest to pin this down. It is clear that there is an attempt, or has been an attempt, to try and build up agents of influence, people who are able to kind of be political voices. I don't actually think that they're necessarily sort of being run by organized crime or anything like that, but it does take money. Mm-hmm. It does take money to do that. And again, I think whether it's the raising or the moving of money and then making sure that it gets into the right hands, or as we would think of it, wrong hands. Mm-hmm. I think certainly one can point to organized crime having had a role there.
Karen, any thoughts before we move on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, hybrid warfare is that there's an enormous amount that can be said and written about this. But I do think that Russia is clearly using it to its advantage. It's a major instrument of Russian power. I wouldn't even call it soft power. I think the idea that this is soft power is really wrong. And you know, the United States would love to live in a security environment where we can see all the threats from satellites. And hybrid warfare, you can't see any of it from a satellite. Mm. So our wanting to see the Russian threat as something that involves maneuvers with tanks on the ground prior to a Article 5 incursion into the Baltics, that's just not going to happen. What's going to happen is what we've already seen happening They're going to crash the Estonian banks. They're going to have Russians who own Lithuanian banks disappear with the money. Same in Moldova, the same in Serbia. They'll just crash the economies of these countries, and we'll never know, because they'll just, these individuals will just walk away. That's where deniable cutouts from these crime syndicates are, and they're not even necessarily from crime syndicates, but deniable cutouts from the Russian state are very useful, because who's responsible for doing what happened to Lithuania when two banks crashed and €1 billion euros was lost for depositors? It's a signal that, you know, on day one of a hybrid warfare attack, we can do it to your whole banking system, mm-hmm. as occurred in Estonia. So they have developed enormously sophisticated penetration of the Baltic states. And what I've said about Lithuania and Estonia goes double, triple to Latvia. And they're not crashing the Latvian bank system because they own it utterly.
Right. So it gives them stealthy.
I think, in fairness, though, there has been quite a bit of progress. I mean, even if one looks at, I mean, I've written about the problems of the Latvian banking system, and indeed got a furious rebuttal from the Latvians. but I mean, I think, in fairness, they actually have made a lot of progress. I mean, one of the interesting side effects of the current crisis is that it really has precisely brought to bear this potential playbook, and in places like the Baltic, well, there are people who are working very, very hard to try and shore this up. I think this is interesting. It's very hard for us to really know, and that's part of its strengths, but also part of its weakness, because I think it's also hard for the Russians to know how effective these instruments would be and how far. I mean, a lot of these issues are, you know, if you look at Moldova, it's not that the Russians sort of crashed the economy. It's unfortunately that the corrupt Moldovans have.
Much in line, the ones who were real winners were in line with Russians.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'd say Latvia is, but generally speaking, I mean, I think, in fairness, the thing is, the Russians' greatest strength are weaknesses in governance in the West, and although there are still many, many weaknesses, and actually, you know, almost as further you go from the front line, those weaknesses remain all the more clear. But certainly in the front line states, I mean, I think, in fairness, things are being done.
Mm. All right, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look closer at what Mark has called the geopolitics of extortion and why it appears to be working. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Oxford, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Haverger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at Miami University of Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Сирия, Путин, Россия. Именно
Россия начинает выстраивать архитектуру будущего мирного урегулирования.
Внезапное решение России активизировать вооруженное
вмешательство. Нет намерений ввязываться в какие-либо геополитические конфликты.
По инициативе Москвы встреча глав внешних...
Russia joined talks in Vienna this week on finding a diplomatic solution to the Syria conflict, and it increasingly looks like any solution is going to be one favorable to Moscow, which suggests that Russia's gamble in Syria might be paying off. Mark, in a recent interview with Voice of America, one which I cited in my most recent blog, you called Moscow's posture the, quote, geopolitics of extortion, adding that, quote, it's probably working. Putin, you said, is identifying a whole series of potential trouble spots around the world, places that matter to the West, and is essentially indicating that he can be either a good partner if they're willing to make a deal with him, or he can stir up more trouble. This is in line with a recent report by Arseny Savitsky and Yuri Tsarik of the Minsk-based Center for Strategic and Foreign Policy Research, saying that Russia is seeking to, quote, promote tension in regions that are a foreign policy priority to key world players, above all in the Middle East and in the Asia-Pacific region. When I step back and look at this, I can't just I can't. The word protection racket just comes into my head. I mean, isn't this how a protection racket operates? They create a demand and then they meet the demand. And if this pays off in Syria, where do we expect to see the next protection racket pop up? Or maybe you'll take issue with my premise. I'm actually curious how you're going to respond to this, since I'm quoting you, but I'm using you to go in a direction maybe you might not want to go in.
Yeah, I mean, is it the sort of the politics of extortion? Well, yes, even though I'm thinking to myself that serves me right for coming out with a.
It was a great quote. Come on.
Spoken like a broadcaster. I think the thing is that exactly from Russia's point of view, they have so few real, shall I say, positive cards at their disposal. He said, mixing his metaphors in an unforgivable way. This is not a rich country. This is not a popular country. This is not actually a country that has much to offer, except that it's willing to break the rules. It's willing precisely to create trouble in ways that might well be very, very incautious in the long term. I mean, most countries are much more risk averse, I think it's fair to say, than the Russians at the moment. But this is what they've got. Now, that said, I mean, I think while we can identify a series of places where they could well think, well, if we need to put a bit more pressure, these are the obvious ones. And that would include, for me, Afghanistan, where the Russians are genuinely worried about what's going to happen. But they also know that they have certain sort of assets and ways of creating trouble. The Arctic region, even though up to now, despite their bellicose rhetoric, the Russians have actually been quite collaborative over. The Balkans, which is an interesting area because it's obviously much more close to home, and the whole question of, and it's something that we discussed in the previous podcast, about addressing Iran and its ambitions in the Middle East, and in a way, again, whether it becomes a sponsor and supporter or whether it actually becomes a quiet obstacle to Iranian ambitions. All that said, though, I think one thing I would point out is they've gone into Syria, in my opinion, for a variety of reasons, including to try and shore up the Assad regime. But in geopolitical terms, primarily because they need leverage to try and get out of the Donbass quagmire with as much honor as possible. And that's why this seems to be working. On the one hand, they've now got the West talking about, well, you know, Assad doesn't have to go immediately. There is scope for some kind of negotiation, yada, yada, the first step on the way. But also at the same time, I think it allows them to nudge Donbass off the Russian TV screens, and also allows them to create some kind of a basis for something, where a deal whereby they can basically pull out of the Donbass and have a certain amount of the sanctions ended. If that works, then in a way there's much less need for further areas of antagonism. Quite the opposite. I mean, they probably are going to want to try and actually smooth relationships with the West rather than irritate them. The issue is that, of course, we don't know if Syria is going to work. And the odds are most countries that intervene in the Middle East do not get what they're after and do not get it quickly. If Syria bogs down, then there is the risk that they'll think, well, okay, how can we, it's sort of constantly kind of a matryoshka, an expanding matryoshka doll. How can we create some new crisis which will hopefully allow us to get out of Syria and the Donbass and so forth? And this treadmill of escalation, God, I'm doing all kinds of metaphors.
No, I like it, though.
This
treadmill of
escalation is precisely, I think, what for me is especially alarming.
Karen, your thoughts? Are we looking at the geopolitics of extortion here? Is Russia running an international protection racket? Or how do you see this?
So if we look at it from the point of view of the very narrow group of people who are making decisions about Syria, I would say that they see Syria more in terms of personalistic interests and less in terms of what might end the conflict. Mm-hmm. Look, Russia has very deep knowledge of the Middle East. They're not newcomers to the Middle East, and they have people who are extremely seriously and deeply trained. None of them is having any role in making decisions about Syria.
Yes, that is clearly the case.
So who's making the decisions? Putin is, and his very small circle, Sergei Ivanov, Lavrov, Shoigu, you know, a couple of others, intelligence folks, but which ones, it's not clear, are making decisions. And over the information and intelligence of Syria specialists, I mean, we all remember, and more into greater or lesser degrees, Yevgeny Primakov. He was a very serious specialist on the Middle East. That kind of knowledge is not being tapped into.
He's got to be turning over in his grave over this one. But
it's really a very rough situation. And when we think of what do this group want most? They want the lifting of European sanctions. They want the splitting of Europe from the United States. Just listening to, and that was hard enough, to Putin's Valdai address, who he went on and on and on about what? About the poor Europeans who would love to be trading more broadly, but are prevented from doing so by these unpredictable and arcane rules imposed by the United States. I mean, we're talking here about RICO, no mistake. So, and not just RICO, sanctions regimes and so forth that are being imposed without the good and valiant companies of Europe knowing in advance who is going to be caught up in the dreadful web of American perfidy. We're not talking here about the American bombing raids on ISIS. We're talking about sanctions. And I think one of the wins for Russia, I think there is the potential for a Russian trail in all of this, but I don't think it's caused by Russia, is the migrant crisis. You know, I spent over a month in Europe this summer, and that's all that was on the television.
No, that's all. Yes. I'm still in Europe, and that is all that's on the television.
That's all. So, you know, they are not talking about the implementation of Minsk. They could care less. What they're talking about is the effect of migrant crisis on their own internal cohesion and the cohesion of the EU more generally. They would love to see Britain withdraw from the EU. So, you know, fanning those flames is really the number one thing. Remember, the sanctions regime can only be lifted in the U.S. by administrative fiat, the same way that it's imposed. But in Europe, it can be challenged in court. And so creating a situation in which it's the challenge, the successful Russian winning of challenges in European courts would bring our, you know, good financial friends, the Rottenbergs, et cetera, et cetera, back to the trading table. That's what a lot of European interests would welcome. And so Syria is just, is so secondary.
But it's transactional, no?
Oh, it's very transactional, but transactional in a bigger sense. Mm-hmm. It's all about Europe. Nobody really cares about the fact that NATO and Russia are now using Syrian landscape as a proving ground for the competitiveness of of their weaponry. It's a very dirty game that's being played in general. One could say that they're also playing different games vis-a-vis the EU. But Russia really would like the EU to forget about Donbass and to focus on America, once again, American perfidy and American escalation and irresponsibility. They're doing to the rest of the Middle East what they did in Iraq and so forth.
Mark, would you agree with that assessment? And if so, is it working?
Well, I mean, in a way, the question is how to make particular Russians' lives easier. And yes, that basically means the sanctions and also, I think, extraction from the Donbass. The Donbass is not just a sanctions issue. It's expensive in a variety of other ways,
right.
Regardless. And yes, the Russians have identified Europe as a potential weak link, but I think it is important this is not purely European. The Syrian issue, after all, is not really about Europe. Syria is very much about Washington. The thing is, Europe has a natural dynamic, a natural drift towards ending crises, ending conflicts, ending confrontations, both for purely pragmatic reasons of a whole variety of national economies, and also just because I think it's fair to say that is the culture of the European Union. It is very much more of a consensual structure, and it is much happier with basically everyone being happy and doing their own thing in global terms. So in some ways, by making Washington more amenable, it's not just about trying to whip the Europeans up against the evil Americans. It's also actually getting the Americans being more willing to, in some ways, let the Europeans off the leash. So, yes, I think there are a whole variety of different tracks, different sort of angles they're playing. But the bottom line is absolutely, this is a case in which they've gone into an area that matters to the West in different ways, to different extents, and they're hoping to bargain that into something that really matters to them.
And if it doesn't work, they'll try it somewhere else?
Well, there is that risk. I mean, just as it is very hard to predict nowadays because the Kremlin is this extraordinarily sort of small circle of people. And frankly, I think I'd be a lot happier if I actually really did feel that someone like Lavrov was really involved in those kind of discussions, because I agree that we have almost a de-skilling of Russian policymaking that has been taking place progressively. So in this case, it's hard to predict. I mean, in a way, all we can do is try and sketch out the parameters of the sort of fans of possibility. And certainly, if I was sitting there in the Kremlin and minded to operate this kind of strategy and say, well, okay, we need to find other ways in which we can bring pressure to bear on the West, it has to be somewhere that really counts. It has to be somewhere that matters. There's no point in saying, these days, Armenia.
Right.
You can bring pressure to bear Armenia, but, I mean, bless them, and my apologies to any Armenian listeners, but frankly, that doesn't really matter that much.
It would matter in California.
Well, it will matter in California. but on the other hand, somewhere like the Balkans or somewhere like Iran, I think actually is a much more neuralgic potential issues.
Well, I would completely agree with that. And of course, one of the reasons why Washington is or parts of Washington are rather catatonic at the moment about the opening of these talks is that not only is Russia there, but Russia is assisting in the emergence of Iran. And Iran is a country which, when we start paying back the sanctions and the money seized in the sanctions, some people put the figure at $60 billion, and open Iran up for international legal trading of oil, it's going to become an even more significant player who can pay for misdeeds. I mean, Russia is paying for misdeeds, but not on the scale that Iran can. So, I mean, we're looking at Iranian troops on the ground in Syria. We're looking at Iranian generals in Syria. We're looking at Iranian generals in Iraq. The emergence of Iran is in some ways a much bigger story than even the emergence of Russia. It's something that I think those people who study the Middle East would not have foreseen, because they assumed that Iran was going to stay behind that wall created by sanctions for a very long time. And of course, it hasn't happened.
And it could very easily turn into a competitor for Russia in the region. I predict it actually probably will.
Yeah, Russia is not, for all of their reputed chess-playing capability, you know, Putin is, as a judo specialist, is just focusing on throwing Iran over his shoulder once. Well, what happens when Iran gets up from the mat?
Right.
And keeps going. you know, if I could say one thing about the migrant crisis and Russia, you know, one thing that's quite difficult for the Europeans that Russia is able to cash in on, if we're talking about underground and intelligence capability and so forth, is that the migrants who are in fact very unwelcome in Europe cannot be framed as anything but poor, simple people who are running away from the ravages of war. That is generally true, and they are finding their own way into Europe. Having said that, there is a whole structure for the migrant crisis that is worth considering, who actually are the individuals who are running the human trafficking networks. They're not poor, and they're not unattached to international criminal structures. In addition, the migrants themselves, many of them are from Damascus. It's clear from the interviews that have been done, which means that many of them of course, might want to not be involved in the war and are seeking to escape, but could also be part of Syrian intelligence trained by the Russians, people who are running themselves but and are fearful of the collapse, but also may have been sent. I mean, if you look at what would an FSB seminar on the European crisis look like, and clearly there would be such seminars, they would look at placing people amongst this group. And Western intelligence is clearly aware of this and is quite worried about it. And I think it's one of the reasons why they are so demanding that papers be properly checked when people are coming into Europe. They don't want people who don't have proper papers running around beyond the control and knowledge of Western intelligence services. Look, the Russians are world masters at almost nothing, except at illegals.
We've seemed to have come full circle here.
They really are good at this, and we would be remiss if we didn't imagine that they weren't using this crisis for a repeat of the Rudolf Abel scenario. So we really should consider that amongst all of the poor Syrians who are running away from war, that there are some who are well placed and some people who are structuring that crisis so that those migrants go northwest and not northeast.
We seem to have come full circle, Karen, with that. And Mark, last word to you on that before we go. I mean, what do you think of that? It's certainly plausible.
I'll be honest, on that I'm a little more skeptical. I mean, yes, the Russians have both demonstrated historically a strength in placing illegals, and they clearly still have a tendency towards it. It's very hard to find real cases these days that illegals actually do much good. And I suppose I find it hard to believe that anyone would really expect that a Syrian migrant washed up on Europe's shores today is likely in any kind of 5-10 year span to be in a position to really be a useful asset. It's so much easier just simply to recruit people who are already in the places you want an agent, rather than somehow hope to very carefully sort of build someone in that direction. It's possible, absolutely possible. I think, to be honest, the greater risk and the issue that is alarming European intelligence agencies more is actually the thought that they have next generations of jihadist terrorists or similar there, or indeed gangsters themselves. Because, I mean, Karen is absolutely right that the people traffickers are serious, well-funded, well-connected, and well-organized crime groups. And the point is, yes, on one level, they're merely about getting people across the waters or over the border. But at the same time, often they will continue to exploit the migrants, say, oh, well, actually, no, you know, you haven't got the right papers, so basically you have to work for us for free, or we'll turn you into the authorities or whatever. And from their point of view, it may well be useful for them to have agents who are in Europe and in migrant communities. That, to me, I think is a greater risk.
On that optimistic note, we'll wrap it up for this week. We're bumping up against the clock. We went a little bit longer than usual, but that is a testament to how interesting the discussion was. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russian organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Oxford, Ohio, has been Karen Dawisha, director of the Heviger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at Miami University in Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, a senior producer for RFERL's Russian language television program Current Time, who is now blogging under the handle at Pasha Butorin, and his feed is as awesome as ever. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Both Mark and I will be attending the Warsaw Security Forum next week, but the good news is we are looking into the possibility of recording a podcast from there, so keep an eye on the Power Vertical Twitter feed for updates on that. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.